So are we settled in?
Good.
Thank you. There's a huge number of questions here. I'm trying to boil them down to just a few to start things off. One of them that's the most clear at the beginning, there's several on this line, which basically say, look, you know, if you're asking can science tell us right from wrong, why should we trust today's science? Because today's scientific findings are likely mistaken. The scientific theories are reliably overturned, not so with moral convictions. What I believe is virtuous is very nearly the same beliefs as Aristotle. Contemporary science is probabilistic, doesn't tell us. And you get the general thrust of that one. I mean, where's the solidity? Where's the certitude that people seem to want from beliefs? Now, you could say that scientists, of course, are not in the belief business, they're in the doubt business, but what's your...
I hear that a lot, and it's one of the biggest misunderstandings of nature science is that scientific revolutions do away with what was before them. That's precisely not how scientific revolutions work. They always keep what worked before them. Einstein may have overturned Newton in a sense, but Newton's laws of gravity still describe the motion of a baseball, and a baseball hit by a bat by the Arizona Cardinals, if it's a million years from now, the next time they're in the World Series, will still be described by Newton. And so what works continues to work. We learn new things at the forefront, but we don't overturn the science that accurately describes nature. And so it's not as if, you know, the argument is given, well, you know, tomorrow everything's going to be different. Why learn science today? That's not true. Whatever we learn at the forefront of science in the future about the brain or about physics, it's not going to change the things that describe reality well now.
Steve.
I think another myth is that Aristotle got ethics right and we haven't made any progress since then. In fact, it's actually quite astonishing to see how morality has historically changed. This isn't a relativist argument that says that every age has its own morality, but I think one could very well make the argument that there has been progress in morality for the same reason there's been progress in science and mathematics, and in fact all of them feed off one another. I don't know if Aristotle had a good argument against slavery, but there certainly was a lot of slavery in Aristotle's Greece. It's not so easy until recently to find sustained arguments saying that there's anything wrong with slavery, or with executing homosexuals, or with confining women to the home, or with rape or with animal cruelty, all of the cruelty to animals. A lot of these arguments are surprisingly recent. They pass into common understanding and common decency. We look at history and we just shake our head wondering how people could do such horrible things. So moral standards do improve, partly in discourse with science.
There are also a number of... Anybody else want to go to that one? There were a number of questions that asked about the spectrum here. I mean, are we just talking about human beings when we're talking about morality, or are we talking about what are we talking about in terms of values and value systems in other animals?
Well, I think I addressed that briefly. I think you can find proto-morality at least in non-human animals. You can certainly find behavior that resembles human moral behavior, and I think at least in the great apes, we can find some evidence of reflection, if you like, or something close to that in terms of what's happening. Now, as I said, we develop that immensely because we're able to reflect on it in a quite different way and discuss it among ourselves and build up a tradition and refer back to Aristotle or Confucius or Buddha, whoever it might be. So there's no doubt that we have something that's, you know, very significantly different from non-human animals. But I also think there's a continuity that we shouldn't deny.
Yeah, there's one question actually talking about animals flourishing without science and without social contracts. How on earth did they manage?
They're dying off.
I mean, one answer would be that they flourished to a degree. They flourished as a species, but of course their lives were relatively short and many of them died because, you know, nature is not that great, really.
They die a horrible death.
Well, that
seems to me to be putting it a little bit strongly. I think that there are, amongst social mammals, quite apart from social insects, there certainly are local practices as well as practices that obtain within the group over time and sometimes are transmitted to other groups. But by and large, of course, the many social mammals have done extremely well. And as long as there are not great catastrophes, such as volcanoes, they really did do quite
well. What do you mean by doing extremely well? You mean the species survived, but many of them died. I mean, we can talk about each species, but it's very common for 90% of the young to die within a month or two of birth in many species, right? So,
like what species?
Well, I mean, take fish, for example.
Oh, no, I thought we were talking about social mammals.
Well, okay, so, I mean...
But social mammals are under... The great apes are under huge stress.
They are now, but I mean, I thought we were talking about while they had a habitat.
But I think that's the point. Without science, they're under extreme stress because of the fact that we're living in a time of perhaps one of the greatest extinctions in the history of the Earth. And, you know, we should tell the new members of Congress who don't believe in global warming that, in fact, we're exacerbating that by our behavior, and science is necessary to reveal the fact that human-induced global warming is going to change our environment, and it's going to produce many more extinctions. So to be kind to animals, we have to, in some sense, use the results of science.
Yeah.
Well, of course. but that's a different issue yet again.
Before we get too dewy-eyed, we might remember that it's the burning of hydrocarbons, which was also a scientific discovery and a technological.
Look, that's right, but that's exactly right. But it's not up to scientists to determine how to use it. It's up to scientists to explain what the consequences are. That's it.
Well, but I think that's one of the issues that came out in our workshop and also amongst the folks out here with a question like, can science tell us right from wrong? It's being construed as being, is it a replacement value system entire, right? So what you're saying is it can inform decisions, but whether it actually becomes a
well, I ultimately think it is, but I think it is even stronger than that. It is, in some sense, the basis of many of our values. Many of our enlightenment values, and I think that's implicitly what many of us in this room are arguing for, exist because of the results of the scientific method and the Renaissance that resulted from them.
I think that's actually a source of confusion. I totally agree with you, but that we're using science in very different senses in this conversation.
Right.
There's a lot of confusion about certainly what I mean by science. I did not mean for a moment to defend science in the very narrow sense as experimental science, men in white lab coats, scanning brains, as the only source of morality, and that's really a straw man. I mean science in a much broader sense, the sort that Steve invoked, of secular rationality and honest truth claims based on honest observation and honest and clear reasoning. And we all are citizen scientists or honorary scientists in many of our moments. And insofar as we're intellectually honest and trying to have our beliefs about the world and our certainty about those beliefs kind of scale with the evidence. And that is the source of clear thinking about the possibilities of human and animal well-being. The crucial thing I want to argue for is that what do we mean when we say that something can be morally good or evil? And is that a truth claim, or is that just merely manufactured based on cultural invention or something that's been drummed into us by evolution and is just a product of our social emotions and emotions like disgust? There are two very different ideas about how science can lead us to strong truth claims about the nature of good and evil. Advocated by Peter here is that science is limited in describing kind of how we got here. So we have evolutionary science, which tells a story about how we got here, and we can understand our what people do and mean in the name of morality in those terms. But it can never make the leap to tell us what we should do. And I think that there's confusion there, because it's one thing to ask, how is it that people come, basically every culture we've ever encountered has come to feel that women are in some sense the property of men? We can tell an evolutionary story about why that's so. We can tell a neurobiological story about what men are doing with their brains when they think that. But we can, in the spirit of science, we can ask a very different question. It's a totally different project. And we can ask, to what degree do people and societies become better? Which is to say, to what degree do they experience greater depths of well-being when they cease to treat women that way? And the answers there, whether or not any of us know them, are answers that fall within our growing scientific understanding of the human mind and all of the ways in which we can see the influences upon it. And again, that is not just laboratory science. That's from genetics to economics. And that's a domain of right and wrong answers, and it is not tied to evolution in any narrow sense. We have flown the perch of evolution, and most of what we care about, evolution cannot see and has never seen. Evolution has not designed us to build a stable global civilization, and yet clearly our future happiness is largely predicated on that.
Can I ask you? Can I ask you a question, Sam? Because I mean, we've had some discussion during the break, and you know, maybe I did take your view of science too narrowly, in which case I apologize. But you just said you want this broader view of science from genetics to economics. Now, I know that if in other cultures, for example, if you think of the German term Wissenschaft, which we often translate as science, it includes philosophy and ethics,
yeah.
You know, as
yeah.
any serious study of a phenomenon. So I wondered why, you know, if you would say not just from genetics to economics, but from genetics to philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely.
If that's
yeah.
all kinds of science, then perhaps we don't really have a disagreement, because we certainly share the view that not only science, but thought, careful thought and rational reflection is how we're going to advance ethics, not through, for example, religious belief or just taking things on faith.
Yeah, absolutely. I think philosophy, there is no clear border between philosophy and science. What I meant to denigrate in my opening remarks are some of the arguments in philosophy that I think are truly useless, and the conceptual distinctions that I think are leading us to miss the very obvious point that there's a difference between the worst possible misery and the greatest possible happiness, whatever that is, and even if there are multiple forms of it. And those differences are fully constrained by the laws of nature. So there have to be right answers, and the right answers are not predicated on whether we can find them. And we do science in the context of that larger reality, which we may fail to fully discover. In fact, we know we will fail to fully discover it. And yet, this includes every possible claim we can make in the moral sphere. And the idea in philosophy currently is that is an incredibly edgy and controversial thesis in moral philosophy and meta-ethics, and I frankly just don't see how it could be, given that every possible experience is only possible based on the nature of the way the universe is.
Could I just ask about that? I mean, it's one thing to know, we know when things are going really badly, and I think you start your book with a scenario in which somebody's just been the victim of atrocities and so on, and just life's as bad as possible. We all know when things are going really, really well. But the construction of a scale, or the idea that there's, you know, whether we know it or not, there's a fixed place, a fixed way of valuing things, that doesn't follow, and I'm not sure it's true. I mean, let's just think of a case. Suppose we went on holiday last year to the mountains, we went this year to the seaside. Was one holiday better than the other? Mm-hmm. Well, I deny that there's a single objective answer to that, which we just don't happen to know, but that some omniscient sort of brain scanner in the sky could measure. Because a lot of it's going to be itself conditioned by value judgments. If my wife and I argue about which holiday was better, she may point out that bad meal we had in the mountain hut, and I might point out the day I got sand in my bathing trunks and so on, but none of this is providing a providing a convergent answer to a definite problem for which there's a definite measure. And I think a lot of human life is rather like that.
Well, life is, all you're saying is life is complicated. That's true. That's why I do physics. But the statement, I think, that Sam's trying to get at, which I'm very sympathetic to, is that you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to determine, and there may be many equivalent solutions to a problem. But without asking, you know, if you wanted to sit down with your wife and say which was better, you'd have to ask some questions about what happened during this and what happened during that, and make some rational assessments based on those experiences. And without doing that, you couldn't address the question at all. And that's, I think, that's the point that I was trying to emphasize. It's very complicated, and for humans, and it may be impossible to actually answer the question. Just like I don't know where every atom is in the air molecules in this room, but you would argue that in principle there's a series of questions and a process by which you might try and address those questions. And I think that's what.
Yeah.
And in
principle, you could be mistaken. You could misremember your holiday. You could fail to know what it was actually like to be you on that holiday, and you could come away thinking, "Well, I love Hawaii; it's my favorite place." And your wife could rightly say, "You were miserable every moment I sat next to you on the beach," and that's just. I mean, we are not incorrigible with respect to or even our own experience of the world, right. And we can be self-deceived, etc. Right. But and there's obviously distinctions that don't matter all that much, and it's not worth it to try to get the details right. But in the limit, it's very clear that we are operating in a space of possible experience that's constrained by the way the world is and the brains we currently have. And the idea that somehow we have to maintain this holding pattern of moral relativism or multiculturalism or just a you all have to make it up for yourselves approach to questions, to the most important questions in human life, is not intellectually honest. We don't all have to make up medical truth for ourselves. We don't all have to make up physics for ourselves. And we don't all have to make up what is actually true of the human mind for ourselves. And it's not a credible thing.
I wasn't arguing that anything's made up, that we make up anything for ourselves.
Well, you work it out for everyone working it out for themselves could be wrong. There's a background truth, and that's all I'm arguing. Sure.
Do we think that the neuroscience, rapidly developing as it is, has any will have any power in helping us understand some of these things? I mean, you talk about flourishing, Sam, human flourishing. Can you think of any neuroscience result that speaks to increases in human flourishing?
Well, that science is truly in its infancy, so it's not.
We have a couple of questions about what does the insula do, what do mirror neurons do. That's why I'm in neuroscience.
I mean, we're beginning to. I mean, people are beginning to study well-being at the level of the brain, but people are. There really is this taboo in science, and it's a taboo you can sort of hear reinforced in this room that it is considered somehow intellectually disreputable or Orwellian or Huxleyan to ever imagine that science can tell us, in a prescriptive sense, how we should live. But there's nothing Orwellian about science telling you, medical science saying, listen, if you don't want to die of lung cancer, don't smoke. You know, there's no men in white lab coats don't descend on every smoker, and we just give the information out, and if you don't want to get lung cancer, well, the first thing to not do is smoke. There's no one in this room who would be indifferent to knowledge coming from science if we said, if we discovered how best to teach children compassion. I mean, surely there are wrong ways to teach children compassion. If an advanced psychology told us, listen, if you do this in the first 2 years of life, you're going to have much more compassionate children than they otherwise would be. Having some scientific understanding of the role that compassion plays in our life, who would be indifferent to that information? Who would feel that it was an Orwellian overreach on the part of psychological science to give that information out? I just don't see the problem.
Pat, do you have anything on neuroscience you want to say?
Well, I mean, a question that I think has come up in conversation with you, actually, is that as neuroscience progresses and we understand more about the various processes underlying learning, that we may be able to find increasingly good methods. In addition to what we know on a behavioral level that allow us to teach better, to teach in a more comprehensive way, to have information in a way that's much more integrated. I mean, ultimately, I think this is, would be consistent with something that, that would interest Sam, is that we might find ways that allow us to make humans more rational in the ways that we go about in the behavioral level, teaching them the various things about the nature of their social world and how to flourish in that social world, how to be good citizens, how to cooperate well, and how to do well. I mean, I don't want to sound Pollyanna-ish about this because, of course, there is tremendous variability in many respects across the population, and not just in things like intelligence, but also in the capacity for sociability and in temperament. And as we discover more about the underlying physiology of, for example, temperamental differences or the degree of sociability, there may be better and better ways of teaching children or bringing them along so that they can flourish in a greater way and so they can be better citizens. So I think those things are really quite possible. At the moment, though, we really just don't know enough about the organization of the brain to do that. But things are progressing at a quite remarkable rate. And so it does seem to me, and I know that you've been involved with the education project in San Diego, but it does seem to me that we may very well be able to achieve greater things in the education process, and in particular, not just with regard to learning math and physics, wonderful though they are, but we may be able to teach better in this broader domain. And so I think those are things that we might want to take into account.
There were several questions that dealt with, I don't want to get into the details of philosophical arguments here, but there were several questions nevertheless did present what I presume is supposed to be the ultimate smackdown here, which is you can't derive an ought from an is. We've heard it lots of times. Could we just dispense with that quite quickly and somebody answer that?
Yeah.
Well, I would love to address that.
Can I?
Sure.
No, I think there's several.
I thought I dealt with that in my talk. We can't get is without ought. I mean, there's science can't justify science. That doesn't make science unscientific. I mean, science can't justify our urge to understand the universe. It can't justify our respect for evidence. It can't justify our respect for logical consistency. That doesn't make it unscientific. Medicine can't justify not wanting to die early. But once you admit you don't want to die early, you can have a science of medicine. These are false problems in philosophy. And that's one of the reasons why I started denigrating philosophy. Because it's just, I mean, people are, you can't believe the email I get from very smart and overeducated people who think that you just that there's no way to argue against the Taliban because they've read some Hume saying you can't get an ought from an is.
You know, it's interesting about Hume. I mean, of course, Simon is the great Hume scholar here, certainly not me, but when you really pay very close attention, what he does seem to be saying is that you can't derive a statement about what ought to be from statements about is. Well, what does he mean exactly by derive? Well, if we take modern logic as our cue here, what he means is that you can't construct a valid argument where the conclusion absolutely follows given the premises. All right, so you can't derive it. So there isn't a logical, that is a deductively valid argument that will do it for you. But what about induction? What about inference to the best explanation? And there what I think is quite interesting, that when you actually read Hume, he himself makes all kinds of inferences about what we ought to do based on the fact. Now, they're not deductively valid inferences, but quite honestly, how one gets around the world most of the time has almost nothing to do with deduction and has everything to do with other kinds of pragmatic inferences. Most days I make many decisions about what I ought to do that aren't necessarily social decisions. And they are not derived using a logically valid argument. They're just inferences about what's a reasonable thing to do. If I have a terrible toothache, I ought to go to the dentist. Given the background knowledge I have, it's a perfectly reasonable thing for me to do. So we can concede Hume's point that you can't derive an ought statement from is statements. But I think all of the time within both the physical world or the physical domain and the social domain, we make judgments about what we ought to do without resorting to a yet deeper rule that tells us, that provides sort of the normative basis. And that seems to be borne out by results in psychology.
I just need to say one thing. The old line from Shakespeare about let's kill all the lawyers, it seems to be let's kill all the philosophers. I'm just looking at a piece here in Sam's book, the footnotes to chapter one, Moral Truth. You gave two reasons why you hadn't. Many of my critics fault me for not engaging more directly with the academic literature on moral philosophy, and then you can speak to this if you want to as well, but there are two reasons why I haven't done this. First, while I've read them, you didn't arrive at your position by doing that. You used logic and so on and so forth. And secondly, you said, I'm convinced that every appearance of terms like metaethics, deontology, non-cognitivism, anti-realism, emotivism, etc., directly increases the amount of boredom in the universe.
I stand by that.
But you see, that's your view, Sam. I mean, I find it really exciting when people
talk
about
wrong. Metaethics. I could be wrong, but
Seems to me there's a problem. I don't understand why. I guess I'll denigrate philosophy. Why appeal to an authority of some? One of the things I like about science is that we don't appeal to anyone usually more than a year old. And when we look at the literature, we certainly don't say, well, you know, what they thought 500 years ago is really, really so significant that we need to do. Who the heck cares what Hume said, it seems to me, at some level, because he was living in a world that knew a lot less than we did. Now, he raised questions that are universal and that we continue to have to ask today. But because he said, but what amazes me is the presumption that there are many examples where it's obvious that you can get ought from is. For example, let's say we determine that educating women will produce societies in the third world that have better economies, that have fewer children, that generally produce more peaceful and sustainable environments. Well, that's determining what a process is, and it obviously leads to an obvious ought. I don't see the.
You have to have the premises. I mean, I happen to share those value premises that you mentioned, but obviously not everybody does.
Why can't you do the same thing? Why can't you attack the philosophical underpinnings of medicine in the same way?
Mm-hmm.
If you're continually vomiting, you should go to the doctor and get X, Y, and Z. But that just assumes you don't want to continually vomit.
Yeah, it does. Exactly.
What about the person who wants to continually vomit?
But that's an assumption. I mean, your example was, if I want to live longer, then I should. But not everybody does want to live longer.
But right? That's shorthand for a whole suite of concerns that everyone recognizes are the only intelligible discussion about human health. And now if we can find one person who says, listen, I like vomiting, I like continuous pain, and I'd like to die tomorrow. He's not offering an alternate medical health-based worldview that we have to take seriously. He just doesn't get invited back to the conference about medicine.
But
so it could be with the conference on morality. That's all.
But look, I do spend time at conferences where we discuss the technological imperative, the fact that you now have more equipment that can prolong people's lives. Should you use it? I mean, that's an ethical question that medicine doesn't really help you to answer.
No, okay, but that's a false use of my analogy. I'm not saying medicine can answer these things. I'm saying that question of whether we should use medicine in this way is intelligible in a larger space where we talk about human well-being.
And so it's intelligible, but it's not answered.
Yeah, right. Well, no, it's hard. It could be hard to answer. There are an infinite number of scientifically coherent questions that we will never answer and we can't answer. The one, my favorite, which I use all the time now, is what was JFK thinking the moment he got shot? Okay, we have no idea, but this is a well-posed question. It has an answer, and we don't know it, but we know what it wasn't. I mean, he wasn't thinking about string theory. He wasn't thinking.
You don't know that.
I know that. And I'll tell you what I do know. He wasn't thinking, I wonder if Sam Harris is going to use me as an example at this conference. Yeah.
He wasn't.
Simon, just answer for me, if you would, Lawrence's point about his ahistorical point there. I remember a review you did of Bernard Williams' books where you talked precisely about the need for the historical perspective.
Yes, I know, it's terrible. You know, science now is being used by Lawrence in the narrow sense that he explicitly said he wasn't using it in. Namely, it's the physicists and chemists who don't read stuff that's more than a year old. And I think he's very wise. He probably shouldn't read Shakespeare or Tolstoy or Aristotle or Hume or Darwin. These are all well over a century old. And of course, they've got absolutely nothing to tell us about life. Absolutely nothing. And the reason he shouldn't read them is that you have to come to read something with a mind which is prepared to accept it. I'm sorry that Sam has come to ethics with its own vocabulary, meta-ethics, emotivism, expressivism, and so on, obviously determined to find it boring. And I'm sure he could find it boring. And many people come to Shakespeare and find it boring, and many people listen to Beethoven and find it boring. And there is no argument that will stop them, and that's part of Hume's point about reason. Bernard Williams, a great moral philosopher, once said that there's a holy grail that some people have, which is to find the argument that will stop them in their tracks when they come to take you away. Now, it's perfectly true, Hume thought there was no such argument. And I believe you can know as much science as you could ever find out, and you'll still not find the argument that will stop them in their tracks when they come to take you away.
Well, that's the point about the ears-ought gap.
And that's the point about not being able to derive morals from reason.
But that's a move you can't make in any other domain of knowledge. We have not found the argument that will convince a majority of the American people that evolution is a fact. Okay, 25% agree that evolution is a fact. It's been 150 years. Mm. Biology, the truth of biology is not predicated on being able to convince everyone. So that's just a straw man argument.
I would also add, I mean, to you're absolutely right in what you said, that these people are worth reading, but they're worth reading with a modern mind. You believe that you, as a philosopher, you believe you have more to say about Hume because you're living in the 21st century where human knowledge, our knowledge of the world allows you to reflect on those same ideas that he was talking about, but with a more prepared and capable mind to do it, in principle. And that's the point that I'm saying, is that we shouldn't take these words on authority. They're interesting ideas, but we've learned something, and we should be prepared to say that they're wrong, or we should be prepared to say we now know better. And I'm sure that, in some sense, as a philosopher, you'd love to write a piece saying we know better than Hume, and here's the reason why.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't deny that we read with more experienced minds in some ways. We've got other sources of authority. We've got other bits of knowledge.
Let's expand it a little bit to think about literature, as you were just doing there. Let me give you an example. Does the name John Coetzee mean anything to you? J.M. Coetzee?
Oh, yeah.
Is a Nobel Prize-winning
I don't pronounce it that way.
Writer with... One of his books was called Elizabeth Costello, one called Disgrace, recently Summertime. There is a volume out now actually called John Coetzee and Ethics. And two of chapters, a short novella called The Lives of Animals, which is from his novel Elizabeth Costello, was actually his presentation as some lectures at Princeton. You were a respondent, Amy Gutman was there, Wendy Doniger, and so on. Could you speak to this point? Because I think it's rather an important one.
I'm sorry, what is...
The question, the intersection of literature and ethics and whether you can find anything of value about this question, the question about morality in here and so on.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think we can. Obviously, you know, I think Simon mentioned writers like Tolstoy or any of the Shakespeare... We can read them, and through them, we can learn to understand what things are like for other people that we might not have grasped. That's obviously valuable. Kutsir, I think, does that. You know, I think what's distinctive about many of his novels is that they pose deep moral questions for us, and that they present sometimes quite explicitly, as in Elizabeth Costello when she's talking about animals and the suffering that we wrongly inflict on animals, sometimes more implicitly in terms of building the context of the situation, as in Disgrace, for example. We are led to think about these questions in a particular context. And I think that that is clearly enlightening. Now, I don't think, you know, if we are taking science in this very wide sense, I don't think it's contrary to what Sam would be suggesting. It's a way of gaining insight, and perhaps it doesn't test it in a rigorous way, but it provides insights which we might want to explore further on.
Yeah, and I wanted then to weave that also, and we're coming to a close now, to Steve, because in Steve's presentation today, where you were actually talking about the escalator of reason, you were talking about things improving, you were talking about the decline of violence, one of the things that you suggested as a factor in there was, in fact, the prevalence and the increase of novels and so on, being able to put yourself in somebody else's mental shoes and so on. So could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, there is when you ask what are the developments that led to the measurable moral progress that our civilization has enjoyed, such as the abolition of slavery and torture and cruelty to animals, one could make the case that an increase in literacy, including the consumption of realistic fiction, played a role. What many novelists do is what many moral philosophers do, that is, come up with a thought experiment, a hypothetical scenario, sometimes preposterous, that clarifies moral intuitions. And I think a lot of fiction does that for us, more artfully perhaps, than, although maybe less precisely than the typical philosophical thought experiment. I mean, just one example is the sequence in Huckleberry Finn, in which Huck is racked with guilt over the terrible thing that's been paining his conscience, namely that he ran away with a slave who is someone else's property. And what did that slave owner ever do to poor Huck that he would be so treacherous as to steal his slave? And then finally Huck says, oh, well, I guess I'm a morally imperfect person. I'm not gonna turn Jim in. Now that's a wonderful way of tweaking our intuitions as to whether moral conviction necessarily leads to morally praiseworthy conclusions. So one way, that's just one of many examples, I think, in great fiction that pushes our moral intuitions via thought experiments. And another is that fiction is an empathy technology. In order to enjoy fiction, you have to project yourself into the life of someone who may be very much unlike you. The rise of the novel in the 18th century did come before the rise of many humanitarian reforms. One can point to specific acts of works of fiction that plausibly led to an expansion of concern. Maybe the most famous example was Uncle Tom's Cabin, which, at least according to Lincoln legend, when Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe, he said, so you're the little lady that started this big war. And there are many other examples in which consciousness of the suffering of a forgotten class of people, or indeed animals, came from reading first-person accounts of what it's like to be that person or that animal. This is all anecdotal and plausible, but there are experiments initiated by Daniel Batson and others where if you bring someone in the lab and have them take the viewpoint of someone when you read their words, you do become measurably more sympathetic to the author of those words and to people in the same class, say AIDS victims or drug addicts. So it's a little bit of experimental support behind the somewhat sentimental notion that reading fiction genuinely is morally uplifting.
I want to just jump in here, partly because we're paying for it, but that one, you all received this notice about science and culture, an origins event that's a four-day event celebrating science and culture in April. And one of the reasons we're involved, I want to come back in some sense to say that, to me at least, one of the things that makes science so worthwhile is not that it produces technology, but it resembles art, literature, drama, all of which have value by forcing us to reassess our place in the cosmos. That's why we like great literature. It forces us to see the world a new way. To me, and to many of us, that's the value of science, is it does the same thing. And so bringing them together is a natural thing, and that's one of the reasons why we're going to celebrate it in April. That's all I want to say.
That's good. And I mean, just going back to Bronowski for you, in The Ascent of Man, when he's at the pool at Auschwitz, he's talking about science, and he says that science is a very human form of knowledge. We're always at the brink of the known. We always feel forward for what is to be hoped. Every judgment in science stands on the edge of error and is personal. Science is a tribute to what we can know, although we are fallible. In the end, the words were said by Oliver Cromwell, "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken." So, your final vote. Can science tell us right from wrong? Those who say yes. And those who say no?
I think you changed some minds.
I think that's a healthy, flourishing situation to be in. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Roger.